has only one cause on its oral submission docket. It is Montgomery County Hospital District versus Valerie Brown from Montgomery County. We've allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral arguments. The chief may reserve additional that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. These arguments are being recorded by our clerk, and you may purchase a tape of the argument by making an application in the clerk's office. The court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioner.
May it please the court. Mr. Tim Rogers and Ms. Carrie Harris will present arguments for the petitioner. Petitioner is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Riley will hold the first 8 minutes. Mr. Riley will present the rebuttal.
May it please the court. Valerie Brown was hired as a laboratory director at Medical Center Hospital in Conroe, Texas in 1981. She was hired by Mr. Everett, who was the administrator of the hospital. At the time, the hospital was owned and operated by Montgomery County Hospital District, a unit of local government of the state of Texas. In 1991, Mrs. Brown was called in by an assistant administrator, Mrs. Spring, September 4, 1991, and was told that there were complaints about the way Mrs. Brown was running the laboratory. Mrs. Brown contends that Mrs. Spring gave her an option to either resign or she would be terminated. Mrs. Spring denied that. In any event, on September 4, 1991, Mrs. Brown gave a note to Mrs. Spring saying, "I'll resign my position by 12 o'clock p.m. on September 4, 1991. The next day, Mrs. Brown submitted a letter of resignation saying that she resigned effective September 25, 1991. On September 5, 1991, the day after, she had a meeting with Ms. Spring, but 20 days before Mrs. Brown decided that she wanted to make her resignation effective, the hospital district issued a paycheck to Mrs. Brown and a severance paycheck, that was for her vacation benefits and for her unused sick leave and the other benefits to which she was entitled by virtue of her voluntary resignation, to which she would not have been entitled had she not voluntarily resigned.
Why not?
Because the employment contract says that the
employment contract?
It's the handbook, the employee handbook for Montgomery County.
Your position is not a contract.
Our position is not a contract, but the handbook clearly says that if she voluntarily resigns, she's entitled to these benefits, but if she's terminated, she's not. She accepted the check, and she cashed that. On September 25, 1991, she faxed a letter back to the administrator of the hospital saying that she had revoked her decision to resign her position with the hospital district. The administrator said, "You can't do that. It's too late. We accepted your resignation effective September 6, 1991. We have paid you your termination pay, and you've cashed that." And Mrs. Brown, shortly thereafter, filed suit on a wrongful discharge and a number of other causes of action, including deprivation of property, liberty, interests, and so on. The trial court granted a summary judgment to Montgomery County Hospital District on all causes of action, which was appealed by Mrs. Brown to the Beaumont Court of Appeals. The Beaumont Court of Appeals reversed, holding that there was a fact issue on the issue of constructive termination and with regard to whether Mrs. Brown was estopped to deny that she voluntarily resigned by virtue of her acceptance of the termination pay. There are two issues before this court. Issue one being whether the at-will employment agreement that Mrs. Brown had with the hospital district should be orally modified, and if so, whether it falls within the statute of frauds. And the second issue being whether Mrs. Brown is estopped to deny that she voluntarily resigned by her acceptance of benefits in conjunction with her voluntary termination. I'm going to address the first issue, the issue being whether this oral contract, this at-will employment agreement, is orally modifiable, and if so, whether it falls within the statute of frauds. My co-counsel, Mrs. Harris, is going to address the latter issue, the estoppel issue. In reviewing the cases on at-will contracts and the oral modification, it becomes readily clear that there are cases all over the board. Regardless of what this court decides to do, it will be very easy to focus on one or two or three or four cases and find that as precedent for whatever the court's decision is. As I look at the cases, I see that there are two lines of cases, one of them being the employment situation, strictly the at-will employment situation, and other being contracts, general contracts, with indefinite terms of employment. In some of the cases, those seem to be confused and mixed together. For example, The Fifth Circuit in 1995 had before a case called Unlimited Floors versus Fieldcrest. This is a case where it was a distributorship agreement that was terminated by the manufacturer without cause. And the distributor comes back and says, well, I understood I had an indefinite agreement unless that there was good cause to terminate the agreement. The Fifth Circuit looked at all the cases that had led up to that, focusing primarily on the employment cases, and said we are convinced that with the line of authorities that we see from the Texas Courts of Appeals, not the Supreme Court, but the Courts of Appeals, we are convinced that the Texas Supreme Court, if now addressed with the issue, would hold that a contract of indefinite length does not violate the statute of frauds, provided that it is possible, conceivable, that the event that terminated the contract could occur within 1 year of the date the contract was entered. But it was a termination of distributorship, not an employment at will case. This court was faced in the Goodyear versus Portilla case 2 years ago with that issue. The Court of Appeals had held that the agreement with Mrs. Portilla that she would not be terminated for violating a policy that they had where she couldn't work if her relative worked at the store didn't violate the statute of frauds. This court wrote an opinion on it and held that the agreement, that was not an issue, and this court was not going to address that issue because there really was no issue that the agreement was in writing, it's just the writing could not be located. Fifth Circuit nonetheless focused on the Court of Appeals opinion. I was unable to find any authority from this court that directly addresses the issue of whether an at-will employment agreement can be orally modified if there is a provision in the agreement that says you will be employed for so long as you do a good job. Looking at the cases from the courts of appeals, there appears to be a distinction that is being drawn by the courts or attempted to be drawn by the courts with regard to whether the employer says to the employee, you have a job here until you die or until you retire, which most of the courts have held that falls under the statute of frauds, and a line of cases that say, you have a job here for so long as you do a good job. You cannot be discharged except for cause. And a number of the recent courts, the Dr. Stacker case that decided in the brief, decided by the Court of Appeals, and of course this Court of Appeals decision in this Ballard Brown versus Montgomery County Hospital District case, make that very distinction. In looking through and trying to reconcile those distinctions, it's very difficult to do. And the reason it's difficult to do is because I guess from a practical matter, you look at if somebody says, I was given an agreement by my employer that I had a job for so long as I did a good job, I guess the next question is always going to be, well, how long did you think that would be? And the obvious response to that is going to be, I think with anyone, is going to be, well, I thought it would be until I died, until I didn't want to work there anymore, or until I retired. Well, if you put it into the latter three categories, any of those three categories, you clearly have a problem with the statute of frauds. I don't think that there's any distinction between an agreement that you have a job for life and an agreement that you have a job so long as you do a good job. I think as a practical matter, every person that gets a job, and maybe that's just changing it with our economy as it changes along, that the general distinction is most people think that they've got a job for so long as they do a good job.
Time is about up.
Thank you.
The statute of frauds is an affirmative defense.
Yes, sir.
Did the defendants plead it?
You know, Your Honor, we did not plead it, and it's not in our motion for summary judgment. However, that was an issue that was raised in the appeal by the defendant. It was not raised in the appellant's brief in the Court of Appeals or in response to our motion for rehearing or on our application for writ of error to the Texas Supreme Court. And I believe the Vaughter v. Garvey case, 1990 case from this court, holds that issue has been waived as to whether it was adequately pleaded or addressed in the motion for summary judgment.
And with respect to your evidence on that subject, in fact, you didn't raise any of this in your motion for summary judgment.
That's true.
Is there any evidence concerning the existence of the contract or the breach of it or the statute of frauds other than the one sentence in Ms. Brown's affidavit?
No, sir. It's her sentence that a fellow in 1981 told her, a fellow who's no longer there, told her that she'd have a job for so long as she did a good job.
But the defendants didn't put on any evidence on that subject at all.
No, and I'm not sure that we could. In most situations, I'm not sure that we could.
So we have to take that statement as if it is true.
I think that's accurate. And then the question is whether we're going to allow an employee to set up a fact issue so that we have a trial in every case where the employee says, and I guess they would always pick somebody perhaps that is no longer available, either deceased or whatever, this person told me I had a job for so long as I did a good job, whether we're going to say that violates statute of frauds.
And to be sure I understand, you don't think the benefits handbook was a binding contract? The Court of Appeals held that. You agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you think employment contracts should be treated differently from all other contracts?
I think we have treated them differently. We're pretty far along the road with treating employment at will as a separate doctrine, separate apart from other contracts.
And why, if that's so, why should we?
Well, we've got a history of law dating back to 1888 with regard to the at-will employment doctrine. I think that the importance of the employment issue in the state of Texas, particularly with regard to employers and employees being able to plan their future, calls for this court to set some specific guidelines in the employment context of what you can and can't do and when you can or cannot be sued for.
Any other questions? The proof problems that you alluded to a moment ago would be identical in any oral modification context,
sure,
would they not?
Sure.
And you're just saying because of the importance of the employment will doctrine, we ought to carve out a special rule?
Well, the court has carved out special rules for the employment area. There are special cases that deal with employment and look at employment differently than other contracts.
As regards oral modification?
Yes. Yes, I do, Your Honor.
My name is Carrie Harris, and I, too, represent the hospital district. I will be addressing point of error number two regarding the doctrine of quasi-estoppel. The Court of Appeals erred in holding that Ms. Brown somehow created a fact issue on the doctrine of quasi-estoppel to defeat the district summary judgment. The doctrine of quasi-estoppel simply is that you cannot retain a benefit from someone and then turn around and take a position that's contrary to the benefit that you received. It's uncontroverted in the summary judgment evidence in this case, and in fact admitted by Ms. Brown in her own affidavit that the district paid her for 2 weeks of work that she did not work, paid her for her unused vacation, unused sick time, unused holiday time, which she would not have gotten had she not voluntarily resigned.
Why not?
Because the policies and procedure manual, which is on in the transcript at 264 and 265, specifically states if you are terminated, you will not receive your accrued benefit. The next page says if you voluntarily resign and give written 2 week notice, you will receive all your accrued benefit.
What if you resign, but it's involuntary?
Your Honor, that is true. If there is a constructive discharge and someone is resigning because they fear they may be terminated,
you get the pay.
Sure, exactly. But that is not before this court, because if this court holds that under the doctrine of quasi-estoppel, she's a stop from even asserting a cause of action or is a stop because she didn't have an employment contract, then you never reach the issue of whether she was constructively discharged, which is not up before this court. That's an issue that would be addressed if this court finds for Ms. Brown on either issue that's before it today.
Your defense is structured on an employment agreement, which is not a contract to the extent that the employee wants to rely on it, but does bind her to the extent there are provisions that you like.
It doesn't bind her to the extent that anything negative to her. All it's saying is that if you resign and you give your two-week notice, you're going to get all these accrued benefits that you haven't used. It's nothing negative to her. Therefore, it's not like we're saying, okay, you've got to do what we say, but we're not going to give you the benefits. It's simply a benefit to her if she gives her two-week notice.
She never signed any release.
She did not sign a release, Your Honor. She was not asked to sign a release. What happened was that the check was cut and it was given to her and on the 5th. She left and never returned after the 5th. She went and cashed the check and has kept over $7,500 that the district gave her that is uncontroverted in Pat Jacobs' affidavit that had she been terminated, that she would have never gotten that money. To date, she has not returned the money. Under the doctrine of quasi-estoppel, once you learn that the other side is taking a position that the money is a retained benefit, you've got the duty to tender it back. That is exactly what Ms. Brown did not do and why she is a stop for bringing her cause of action. this is a case of first impression for this court.
Are you saying she had an enforceable right to compel the district to pay her that money?
Exactly, Your Honor. She.
So there was a contract?
There was not a contract. It was a right under the policies and procedures manual that...
Well, what's the nature of the right?
Simply that if you followed the rules and did what the district asked you to do, i.e. give 2 weeks notice so there would not be an interruption in the employment for the hospital, then
where's,
you would...
Where's the mutuality in terms of her obligations? What were her obligations under this agreement?
She had no obligations whatsoever until she filed suit. Once she filed suit and the district filed a summary judgment saying, we're taking the position that you're a stop from bringing this cause of action because you've retained over $7,500 of us for a voluntary resignation, and now you're saying we terminated you, you now have the obligation to either drop your lawsuit or tender back the money.
And your position is she could have compelled the district to pay her that money under some sort of contractual agreement?
She could have compelled the district to do that under the policies and procedures manual, exactly, Your Honor. And once she took the money, which we gave her, that was not an issue that whether she was entitled to that or that she didn't get it. Once she gave it to us, and then she turned around, or we gave it to her, she turned around and filed suit, the district took the position of estoppel, then she was, under the Fifth Circuit case of Grillett, entitled to either do one of two things, drop her lawsuit, or tender back the money. She can't do both. She can't keep the money and say, you gave me this money under the policy because I voluntarily resigned, but now I'm going to sue you saying I was constructively discharged or terminated. She can't have it both ways. And to date, she has never tendered back that money.
The Court of Appeals remanded the due process claim. It is your contention, apparently, that if she doesn't have a contract, she doesn't have a due process claim?
Exactly, Your Honor. Ms. Brown contended that in her appellate brief. The Court of Appeals contended that she has no cause of action unless there is a contract that was breached. She can't get to the next step of having due process, liberty, interest, or anything else.
Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court. Mr. Larry Watts will present argument for the respondent.
Chief Justice Phillips, Justices of the Court. The last question raises an interesting point. Due process issue. It's believed by me that due process or due course of law is triggered where you have a protectable interest such as life, liberty, or property, and that property interest has historically been defined as something more than at will. We have an interesting case that is in Texas. It's one of those anomalies. That came out of the Austin Court in 1995, Cope versus Rivera et al., which says that even though you have an at-will employment situation, you may still be entitled to the due process. I'm not sure whether that's a failure of the court to understand due process and when it's triggered, or whether that represents a divide line that we'll follow in the future as to whether or not at will truly is a protected property interest.
And your argument is which?
My argument is that property interests protected, which are defined by either state law or agreements between the parties, are some widespread practice tantamount to a policy. Maybe found to exist within the context of that will.
Is there any summary judgment evidence of anything to support a due process claim in this case other than the alleged contract, oral and the handwritten?
Well, certainly in response to the question, I think that any time that government makes a representation of policies that will be provided our procedures will be provided by policy, then the government should be expected to live up to its statements. But in direct response to the question, I think that when you have the oral modification of the employment situation, that constitutes a protected property interest. And that's what Perry versus Senator of the Supreme Court of the United States said when it wrote in 1972 on the issue.
None of these issues are in the motion for summary judgment. But you've not complained about that on appeal?
No, I did not complain about that.
So as far as you're concerned, we can address all these issues in substance, even though they were not raised in the trial court?
No, the motion for summary judgment was limited, and we tried to address the motion for summary judgment and the issues that it raised.
Well, no, you raised these issues, actually,
and,
in your response. Although,
and what we were arguing was, by analogy, whether or not oral contracts can exist oral modifications can exist to at-will situations. And I do that by virtue of the fact that in the Perry versus Sunderman case, and in Roth, it's the case that came down with it, the court indicated that private agreements may be enforceable. With regard to the due process, anytime that you have a public employer, a public employee, there is always the possibility that if you have an enforceable modification of a relationship, that you have a protected property interest, and it was by way of analogy and by an extension of the arguments at the court, the district court that we argued.
Mr.
Maybe
Wall,
not all the not too fair. Yes.
The Court of Appeals said that after Ms. Brown rescinded her resignation in the letter to Mr. Bremer, that this letter stated that she intended to activate due process through a grievance procedure. And then the court said 3 months later she sued. Does that mean that she did not invoke any grievance procedure?
She could not. The reason she couldn't invoke any grievance procedure is because the grievance procedure, according to Bremer, was only available to employees. She considered herself to be an employee up until the 25th because that was basically the term by which the agreement was reached. Bremer comes back and says that I have the authority to and did accept your resignation on September 6th. Since September 6th, you've not been an employee. Since you're not an employee, grievance procedures don't apply. The issue that I think that is probably most clearly stated in the oral modification is whether or not there's going to be a disparagement of the right of contract in this state. And my thought on that is that contracts, whether they're oral or written, can't be fractured or balkanized into different types to protect, for example, an employer in some instances, employees in others, car salesmen in some, car purchasers in others. Contracts are contracts are contracts.
Mr. Watts?
Yes, sir.
What is the oral modification in this case?
The oral modification was a quality contingency that as long as the performance that was rendered by Ms. Brown was satisfactory and did not compel or provide basis for termination.
Isn't that in every employment at will contract?
No, sir.
Employment at will contract means you're going to work at the pleasure of the employer. There's an assumption there that as long as you do a good job, you've got a job.
I don't think that's true, and with all due respect, sir. I think that in employment at will, what you have is a situation where the employer says that I don't have to have a reason to terminate. Now, some bright arguments to sell that and make it more palatable to employees have been urged that, well, but you can leave at any time. I think that the very fact that you don't have to give a reason, that you don't have to justify your act, is the very heart of the at-will situation, and that once you depart from that, once you start saying, well, I by agreement with you will have to justify my act, I will have to have a basis act, then you're moving from clearly an agreed-upon arbitrariness to a non-capricious level where you have to follow some standard of reasoned analysis in making an employment decision.
If that is so, shouldn't we require that be in writing?
I don't think so. If you require, with all due respect, if you require that be in writing, then what you're doing is you're limiting the right of people to contract. In a quote that I found in preparation for today.
Well, are you arguing that you can't do that? That you can't limit the right to contract? Has the legislature done that by the statute of frauds?
The statute of frauds, the statute of frauds is, and going back to the Charles II statute, it, I think, has a history that is not so much a limitation on the liberty of contract as it is to ensure that certain agreements will be free from imprecision of memory.
So what's wrong with having that same policy apply in at will contracts if you're going to alter them between the parties? You ought to put it in writing. So
we do have that law in certain instances. If we have an express at will contract, Texas law says that you can't modify that express at will contract except by a written agreement that does that. And I say express, I'm talking about a written contract. If you have a written at-will employment relationship, then you can't modify that, or you have to modify that in writing. I don't think that,
So your alternative is if it's an oral at-will, you can orally modify it, that's the end of it.
I think that if you have a presumed at-will, it may be orally modified. I think that human beings, we're always going to have...
Well, what is an unpresumed at-will?
Where you have an express written contract.
Okay.
What was the term of Ms. Brown's employment under this oral modification?
It was a quality contingency. Not a time duration, but a quality duration.
So there was no time contemplated by the parties?
I don't think that there was any time contemplated by the parties of representation that was made to her by the authority who had the right to make that representation, the administrator.
Why is it implicit in the oral modification that you argue was made that it was for an indefinite period?
It is an indefinite contract. Mm-hmm. It is a non-durational contract.
But consummated in less than a year?
It could be consummated in less than 30 seconds. If Ms. Brown had come in and had, for some reason or another, taken every Corvette in the laboratory and bashed them, I suppose that she could have been terminated within 30 seconds of her arrival and bashing the Corvettes. The point is that it was a contract that was specific. All he had to do, or she had to do, Bremer and Spring had no more of a responsibility under the agreement than to simply say, these are the reasons you're being put in the position that you are, to either resign or be terminated. They had to state a reason. Then, once that reason was stated, it could be challenged. There could be some form of screening of that reasoning to see whether or not it was arbitrary and capricious. I mean, after all, that's not a new concept that we're dealing with.
Is the sole basis for this agreement one sentence in Ms. Brown's affidavit? In the record?
In this record, as I recall right now, I think that's right. Whether it's one sentence or whether it's several words, the idea, I think, is
at the time I was hired, as well as during my employment, I was told by the hospital administrator that I'd be able to keep my job at the hospital as long as I was doing my job, and that I would not be fired unless there was good reason or good cause to fire me.
Great ideas don't necessarily have to be stated in many words. God is love is only three, but the idea is tremendous.
Usually when we're forming a contract, we don't rely on such casual conversations.
I don't know that that's true. I think that when we do form agreements and when we try to assure people of their ability to rely upon what we say, it's not measured in word poundage, but
in
authority and sincerity.
Your position is that a statement that an employee makes in what appears to be on no particular occasion and in a fairly offhand way conveys this lady constitutional rights.
She wasn't challenged to give any more specific statement than that. Had she been challenged to give more specific statement than that, then she could have given more specific statement.
Well, that's one of the problems with the record.
Well, I understand.
But as I understand your position, the fact that this was not raised or discussed at summary judgment except in your response is not a reason for us not to consider it on appeal. That has been your position on appeal.
And the way you say that, Justice Seck, makes me suddenly very uncomfortable with what has been my position on appeal and what my answer may very well be.
Comfortable or uncomfortable, I'm just trying to get at the facts.
Well, I want to be candid with you, and I wanted to tell you that I am very uncomfortable. I think that the issue was not raised by them, and it has been addressed by us as to why the court should not have done what he did at the district court level. There is a certain obligation, I feel, that we as attorneys must bear to the court. Judge, you made a mistake, and here's why. So that, did I avoid or did I answer?
You don't want to ask me that.
All right. Then I must have not done well in the answer and must have avoided ungracefully. I think that the whole issue...
It is your position that statute of law is going to apply to this casual conversation had been, you'll be hired here for 16 months no matter what, no matter how badly you do. And that was an oral remark.
If it was an oral representation or an oral contract that exceeded, could not be performed within the year, but the performance required more than a year, then statute of frauds would apply, yes.
So you weren't asking for some special rule of employment contracts to be...
Absolutely not.
Outside the statute.
Absolutely not. I think the statute of frauds should stay as it is. Nor do I think there should be some special rule for employees. I don't think that the law should be pro-employer or pro-employee. I think it should be pro-contract. In 1928, this court was quoted in an opinion, and in the quote that came out of this court in St. Louis Southwestern Railroad versus Griffin, the writer for this court said that the citizen has the liberty of contract as a natural right which is beyond the power of government to take from him. Having some affection for law and for natural rights, I find some consolation in that. I think that that's still the law, and I think that that's why this court should not carve any specific right less than what is given by that natural right.
Explain, though, if the purpose of the statute of frauds is to cut down on faulty memories and disputes, how does that fit a contract that is indefinite in its term? Even though it could be performed within a year, these people could be arguing about this statement that Mr. Everett made 20 years hence.
Well, interestingly, first of all, there's no evidence that has been presented or suggested. No, that's not true. It has been suggested to you today that the genesis of this statement to Ms. Brown would be challenged were the administrator brought forward. And it's also been suggested that the rules change from administrator to administrator. I'm also fond of that old adage that we're a nation of laws and not of men, and especially that was a governmental, when that's a governmental entity. Now, with regard to the statute of frauds, that document was originally, or that concept was originally innovated to protect title to land. And I had occasion recently to read Bacon's, a memoir of Bacon's first speech to the end on that very issue. It didn't deal with employment contracts. Now, it was focused mainly on various rights of property that were real in nature. There were some fiefdom rights that were attached. I think that the statute of frauds applies now through the fifth article or the fifth section to employment agreements simply because we're talking about any contract, not simply employment contracts, but any contracts that can't be performed within a year. Would it be forever discussed or disputed? I have seen litigants in defamation cases or in fraud cases where material representations were made with purpose to induce performance and thereby injure, discussed for years as to whether or not that representation was made.
Before your time expires, why was not the acceptance of the last paycheck an estoppel because she knew it was separate?
Well, I think that the case they cite, we've seen a whole line of cases in age discrimination and other discrimination instances where companies want to cut back RIF. And what they do is they say this is consideration for your signing a release. The cases that they cite deal with that issue. Is severance a consideration? Is it buying a release? Chief Justice Phillips asked if there was a release involved. I presume that may have been related to the concept. No, there was no release. These were accrued benefits. These were earned benefits.
They take the position she would not have been entitled to them if she was terminated.
Well, I'm not sure that that's exactly. I heard them take the position that she would not have been entitled to them had she been terminated. And it may be that that was the carrot that led the goat down to the resignation trough. But the point is that they say also that she would have had a right under the facts to compel them to pay her. I think that the issue is that it was accrued, it was earned. It was not for future. It was not some largesse, as the court remarked. It was something.
Excuse me. Is it factual that she did not work any time past September 6th?
She was on leave.
That she was paid for 2 weeks? That's their position.
Well,
and that's why.
There's no evidence before the court below, either at the trial level or at the appellate level, as to whether or not that absence from work was by leave, was by some agreement that you'll stay away pursuant to suspension prior to the 25th?
Well, would you agree that it is factual she didn't work past September the 6th?
I will agree that she was not on site after the 6th.
Would that lead you to the conclusion that she's not on site, that she was not performing the duties that she had performed before September 6th?
I'm not sure that. I'm not trying to duck this. I don't think so. Here's why. I'm familiar personally with a situation in HISD where a teacher has been off-site, unemployed, on medical leave for 2 years, and yet is still registered by a governmental unit according to the laws of the state of Texas as a full-time employee. I don't know exactly what the
policy. So what does that have to do with this question? Did she work or not?
Well, she was not on site. Okay. Since she was not on site, she was not there doing something on site. But that's not to say she wasn't on call. That's not to say that she couldn't have been forced to be there. That's not to say that she was without obligation to respond.
A couple of quick questions. The quality contingency that you refer to,
yes,
that she would be employed so long as she does a good job, will that determination be a subjective or objective test?
Well, I'm sure that as beauty, it's in the eye of the beholder. But I think that whether it be subjective or objective, I think it shouldn't be arbitrary and capricious. And we know some definition by that. That's been defined as being to escape the label of arbitrary and capricious. It has to be some reasoned analysis. So I presume that it would be. To answer your question, I presume that satisfactory performance would be, or quality performance would be, some performance that would be challengeable by recent analysis.
So the distinction then that you make between a pure at-will employment situation and the situation that you claim Ms. Brown is in is that with pure at-will, the employer could be arbitrary and capricious. The quality contingency would eliminate an employer from being arbitrary and capricious.
At will is, I think, arbitrary and capricious per se. It's okay. It's okay to be arbitrary and capricious if you're really at will. But the problem that we've got, if I may just for a moment, is having employers say to employees, look, you work for me so long as I want you to work for me. Instead, we have employers who need employees and who will induce that employee to have some sense of security. the truth should be the truth. And if you're going to hire somebody and make a representation to them, whether you're government or whether you're an individual, your yes should be a yes and your no should be a no, and you should be held to honesty. I believe that. So I think that at will is per se arbitrary and capricious, but it's okay arbitrary. Thank you very much for the opportunity. Yeah. It's always
thank you. May I please report? There are issues in this case that are of some great importance. This particular plaintiff should be stopped. There is no question that this particular plaintiff, it was uncontested before the trial court, would not have been entitled to the $7,000-something she got had she not voluntarily resigned. There may be an issue as to whether that's a contract or whether, because this is a public entity, whether she had a property interest and therefore could have compelled it in accordance with due process rights.
Are you taking a conflicting position with your co-counsel? Or are you?
I don't think so. I'm just trying to clarify that it's not a contract, but because it is a public entity, she may have been entitled to compel that because it was a public entity. She was a public servant. That is an issue in the case that could be present were the case to be remanded. There may be additional issues as to whether she exhausted her administrative remedies. I don't think that is before the court. That was not a part of the Court of Appeals' opinion. There may be additional issues as to whether any employee of a public entity has a right to create a contract essentially for life for the public entity. Again, that was not a part of the motion for summary judgment. It's not a part of what's before this court. What is crying out for clarification in this state is the issue of what do we do about at-will employment contracts where the employee says, after they were terminated, I was promised a job for so long as I did a good job.
If the if there was an express term of 6 months, would that contract be orally subject to oral modification?
That is an excellent question, and I guess it leads to the next comment I was going to make. There's three ways that issue could be addressed.
And you'll answer my question, then go to the comments.
Okay. The answer is, it depends on which way this court rules. I would advocate that, yes, that should be enforceable if it was 6 months.
Okay, because it's not subject to the statute.
Correct. The courts of appeals have gone all over the board on these issues. And as I said earlier, what I see them trying to do is draw some kind of a distinction between a lifetime contract and a contract that says you've got a job for so long as you do a good job. It's an illusory distinction. In fact, the most interesting case I found is the most recent one that wasn't cited in our brief, Ward v. Young, a 1996 Waco Court of Appeals opinion, 917 Southwest 2nd, 506, where they tried to make that distinction, and in reading it, I found the distinction more confusing than I've seen in any other case. They tried to clarify and bring it all together.
But just to be sure that you hinge the difference on the statute of frauds, I gather, by your answer to Justice Corwin's question. If this had been a six-month agreement, you say an oral modification would have been all right. If it's for some indefinite period, you say the statute of frauds prohibits
it. I'm saying that I believe, is the way this court should clarify the law, yes. This court could do one of three things. It could say, try to carve out the same distinction that the Court of Appeals did.
But
say,
based on the statute of frauds is my question.
Yes.
That's
the
touchstone.
Yes. This court could say that there's this distinction. Since the person could quit performing satisfactorily within a year, that distinction is such that the statute of frauds does not apply. The court could alternatively say that with an at-will employment agreement, we're going to state that it is not orally modifiable, period. No ifs, ands, or buts. That's a bright-line distinction.
Is there any other area of the contract with the court has used the statute of frauds as it's taking off the point and then created a separate rule because of the subject?
Not that I'm aware of, Judge. Although I think if we look at the statute of frauds cases themselves, and if we look at the historical development of the statute of frauds, it's consistent with the concept of the statute of frauds, why you want to have a separate rule of law for contracts that can't be performed within a year. If I may finish.
What's your third option?
The third option is to hold that the oral at-will agreement
is modifiable orally so long as there is a fixed term of 1 year or less. That the moment that you put a term of indefiniteness in it, such that the employee will not be discharged except for cause, or the employee has a job for life, or the employee has a job until they retire, that the contract should be void under section 4.
But there's a general principle sort of floating out there that a contract that can be performed within a year, even if it is for an indefinite term, is not a bar, but is not unenforceable under statute 12. So this would have, at least two of these options would have to be a change thing.
I think it's a clarification, and consistent with this court's ruling in the Schrader versus Texas Ironworks case.
But we would, you don't argue that that clarification should be made in every other kind of contract, only in this kind of contract. It's not clear what the ramifications would be in other areas of contract. Is that true or not?
It is true. I think what's before this court is an employment at-will case, and it should be treated separately.
You've given us more Texas cases than I ever knew were out there on this point, more than I want to read. But no law from any other jurisdiction. Are you asking us to do something that's in the mainstream of American law among those states that recognize the at-will doctrine? Or is it something that would be 5 years?
I focused on the Texas cases. I'm not prepared to address that. I'd be happy to do a letter brief addressing what the majority of jurisdictions have done.
That would be helpful. Any other questions? That concludes the oral argument in this call. This call will be submitted on briefs and oral arguments, and the marshal will adjourn the court.
All rise. Oh yay. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.
Thank you.